We turn now from one European country paralyzed by debt to another with much the same problem. Iceland has been in the grips of a tumultuous economic downturn for the past 2 years, and now it's engaged in a bitter diplomatic row with parts of Europe over how and when to repay its debt, and it threatens to isolate the country even further. We're joined now by Landon Thomas Jr., a financial correspondent for the New York Times based in London. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today for our second underreported segment. Hi.
How are you? Thank you.
And we were just talking about Greece, something you've also written about. Do you see any parallels between the situation in Greece and Iceland?
Yeah, I mean, broadly there really are, because both of these countries, in different ways, took on tons of debt and overextended themselves. Iceland through its over-aggressive banks, and Greece through its through a government that was just addicted to debt and spending. And so when times were good and liquidity was loose and people were free and happy to do what they want with their money, both of these situations, you could move forward with it. But once the crisis hit, interest rates went up and banks began calling in their loans, it all collapsed. So yeah, it's another tale of how leverage can bring you down in the end, no doubt about it.
You wrote the other day about Greece's economic problems, noting that Prime Minister Papandreou's disparate policies may be a result of having a wide range of advisors. He's sought counsel from Joseph Stiglitz on the one hand and Gary Deacon, the president of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, well, you know, it is a little ironic because Stiglitz is an arch critic of tough spending cuts and austere policies, the type of policies, in fact, that Iceland is actually being forced to undergo due to IMF participating in an IMF program. And even though Greece is not working with the IMF, it basically has to do the same thing, which is rein in out-of-control public expenditures, fire people. In effect, the public sector is incredibly bloated, but at the same time, it needs to raise money to pay its debts, and the only way it can do that is persuade investors that it is going to do the very things that Professor Stiglitz is saying it shouldn't do. So it probably is kind of a sort of one of those rich dilemmas that one finds oneself when you're caught in the vortex of one of these crazy market meltdowns.
And isn't there a possibility that the IMF will also get involved in Greece?
I think a lot of people are saying it's a cleaner, simpler way to address the problem because the IMF is expert in these matters, is technically proficient and experienced in these matters. It knows exactly what to do in these matters. It has the capital, which is there for that very purpose. In fact, the capital was doubled during the as a direct result of the crisis to give it ammunition to deal with these very problems. So the IMF has been sitting there ready to do this, and in fact, the managing director, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, said, "We're ready, we're here, let's get to work if we're invited." But European pride is a sensitive thing, and not just Europe as the Eurozone is very reluctant to let the IMF come in because to some extent that would represent some failing on the part of Europe as a whole. But Greece on the ground is also very reluctant to let the IMF come in because that brings forth all sorts of associations of American control and pseudo imperialistic tendencies and that kind of thing. So,
we could even see it on in the United States. California wouldn't want the IMF to come in and help it bail out
its
economy.
The IMF has a reputation of just coming in as a strict school marm and slapping the knuckles of out-of-control schoolboys, or in this case, out-of-control government officials and bureaucrats, and no one likes to have their knuckles wrapped. And but in the end, some people say, well, you know, so what? That's what you get for living beyond your means, and best to go about it swiftly and directly and leave hurt feelings and sentiments to the side.
Well, let's take a look at how a small country like Iceland could get into such a huge financial crisis. You said one of its key problems was over-leveraging.
Yeah.
Were Iceland's three major banks operating in a way similar to Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns were here before our crash?
You know, I mean, to the extent that the chief executives had these sort of grandiose visions that they could do what they wanted and that leverage would allow them to do whatever they wanted, i.e. they didn't have the cash or the capital to do these sort of things, but they had the ability to take X amount of cash and times that to X times 10 amount of cash. So whereas Lehman Brothers could go and invest in commercial real estate to its heart's delight, Iceland could go and, make purchases along London's high street and buy banks and retailers and all by borrowing too much. And so that's how you saw British consumers putting their money to work in iSave and in the subsidiaries of ambitious Icelandic banks and that were offering too good to be true interest rates. And so yeah, that's it was all a sort of an extension of the classic traits of avarice and hubris and all those other Greek terms one sees when one gets in a situation. So yeah, now Iceland's trying to dig itself out right now.
iSave was an internet arm of Landsbanki.
Yeah.
Was it fairly aggressive in courting foreign investors?
Well, it wasn't.
And what happened to all the money
It was really what it did is it courted British depositors, and so that's the essence of the problem is that you had. They somehow felt that they could compete with Barclays and Royal Bank of Scotland on the British High Street by creating these internet bank accounts with very high interest rates, and so they attracted billions of dollars of depositors. And then when it went bust immediately, there was this great sort of collective head scratching in Europe. Well, now what do we do? How does this work? This has never happened before. I mean, whose responsibility is this? And so the UK and the Dutch, because there were branches in the Netherlands as well, had to come in and make whole these depositors, but now they want their money back.
Germany was also invested heavily in Iceland, wasn't it?
You know, to a certain degree, yeah, but I think the iSave crisis centers really on the UK and the Netherlands and basically them coming to Iceland, which has got no money at all now, and saying we want our money back, but Iceland is now saying, well, we can't afford to pay $5 billion at a time when we're in such an awful condition, and why should we do this? Because it was our ridiculous banks that got us in this trouble in the first place, and British and Dutch authorities are saying, well, that's not our problem, that's your problem. So it's got into sort of arcane legal territory about, well, whose responsibility is it? I mean, is this a collapse of the collective regulatory system, or is it really Iceland? Do we bankrupt Iceland again just to sort of make up for its terrible bankers? It's a broad, you know, it's something that it's not a cut and dried type of scenario. No way.
Well, how does the size of the country's collective debt compare to its GDP? Isn't repaying the iSave debt estimated to cost each Icelandic family around $60,000?
Yeah, it takes on it. Iceland is already one of the most indebted countries per capita, or as a comparison to GDP. I think it's almost 100% of, you know, its debt equals its GDP. But taking on because Iceland will have to borrow to pay back, they take on more debt, and so then they become leveraged almost like the banks that got them in trouble in the first place. So that's what infuriates people on the ground, because they see, and it's one of the points that himself has pointed out, is like something is missing if, as a result of trying to fix these problems that the banks got themselves into, that you're in a situation where you're creating, say in Iceland's case, a country that itself becomes over-leveraged. So, you know, the people have really, I mean, I think the one sort of takeaway from all this is what we're seeing in Greece and what we saw to some extent in Spain and what we saw in Iceland is a sort of a rising up of a collective voice of people on the street saying enough, we can't pay for the sins of our bankers forever. And that's what drove the president of Iceland to say, to sort of to scotch the deal and say, guys, go back to the drawing board. And to some extent, it was the strikes in Greece that also, I think, pushed people and pushed Germany to sort of say, well, look, this could be a problem if it spreads, if social unrest spreads to Spain and to Portugal as well.
My guest is Landon Thomas Jr., financial correspondent for the New York Times, based in London. We are talking about the situation in Iceland, an update on our second underreported segment here. What about the people in Iceland? I assume many depositors lost their money there as well.
Yeah, they did. And you know, so they feel that they've already, I mean, the economic conditions there are quite awful, because they're going, unlike Greece, which should be remarked, that Iceland is already undergoing a severe IMF-dictated austerity program where there are massive public sector cuts and people have already lost their savings, and now, you know, there's a huge government retrenchment there. So it's like it's a double blow to them. And now on top of this, they've got the prospect of taking on the government taking on more debt. But I think in some ways it's almost symbolic. There's a real anger that, you know, they've lost everything, and now they're being put in a position of being smacked around some more. There's a real sense that they're being taken advantage of because they're so small. They don't have the weight. It goes back to, you know, the UK invoking anti-terrorist laws to actually go in and reach a solution here. So they're the real nationalistic kind of underpinnings here, in the sense that this is unfair.
Now, why did the British government use anti-terrorist laws to freeze the assets of Icelandic banks?
That's a good question.
I mean, obviously that's not what happened, and Iceland's president has said...
I think it's a good question. I think everyone was so panicked, and no one knew what the heck was going on, and that they did... I don't know. I mean, I don't think there really is an answer for that. I don't think the Labour government has really explained why. Well, were they afraid that there was going to be a run on Icelandic banks that would create a run on English, on British banks? It's not entirely clear, and I'm sure that if they were given a do-over on that one, they'd probably take it and say and not use that sort of inflammatory language, because in the end, that is why they don't yet have an agreement, because there's such anger there that it was this popular uprising that was to a large extent driven originally, sort of originating it from how... you know, the language that was being used that, you know, caused these people to rise up and caused the president to say, okay, we can't do this. And so, you know, the bottom line is that the British still haven't gotten their money back.
Well, Oliver Grimson, the president, says that for centuries, Gordon Brown will be remembered in Iceland long after he's forgotten in Britain for lumping Iceland with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
But does Britain worry about how the people of Iceland feel about them?
Probably not. I think Gordon Brown's got bigger problems than having to fear what a man on the street in Reykjavik thinks of him. But, you know, the bottom line is that they're out $2.5 billion largely because of the language that he used. So he may not care, but it's so far he doesn't have an agreement, and Britain needs the money. So you know, in the end, the lesson is as words can come back to haunt you.
Fitch Ratings cut Iceland's credit grade to junk, which has that ever been done before with a developed country?
Well, I mean, I think countries like Argentina and Russia, I guess more in the developing mode, have actually come to the point of bankruptcy. Iceland is not bankrupt yet because they still have an IMF program that they're working through. But yeah, it's you know, they're kind of like a junk bond right now. But they haven't gone to the final stage, which is defaulting. They haven't done that yet.
But won't a junk rating hurt its potential for a recovery?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's a whole circular kind of connectivity here, because as long as there's no agreement on this ICESave deal, then they have trouble getting the money. They can't raise money on international capital markets because of their status. So they're really dependent on the IMF, which is dripping funds into the economy. But that's all sort of contingent on if not officially, unofficially, on reaching a deal here. And so it's very hard for Iceland, which wants to sort of recapture some sort of respectability in the international financial community. It's hard to do it as long as this battle is going on. So it's their issue number one. For Britain, it's kind of issue number, 50. So it's a big deal, but and I think that's part of the problem is they're like, well, we want our money back, but we also got bigger problems. Where for Iceland, it is their big and only problem, and I think that's part of why we have this continual sort of, this ongoing complication is that.
Well, but in Iceland, I think they also see themselves as the little guy has been taken by the big guy.
Yeah.
Writing in the Financial Times, John Danielson of the London School of Economics said the original agreement between the three countries in June was too good to be true for the UK and the Netherlands. They employed a professional negotiating team, achieving almost all of their demands against a politicized and inexperienced negotiating team from Iceland. It was kind of like the local football team in Iceland was playing Manchester United.
Yeah, no, I know John. He's been very critical of the deal, and yes, you can find respectable people who say that the original deal that was struck was unfair, and in fact that's why it couldn't be confirmed. And
We have very little time, but there are two issues here that I want to deal with very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
One, there's going to be a referendum in Iceland. I don't know whether there's ever been a referendum before and what it will mean if they reject any kind of a plan. And second, isn't Iceland trying to join the European Union? Doesn't this make it almost impossible?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people say that they never really were serious about doing that, and so it was never a given that they were going to do it. But it's certainly for those that want it to happen, this doesn't help. And as for the referendum, that's in March, and they're trying desperately to get a deal done to go back to the negotiating table, Iceland and its European partners, to get a deal done before the referendum, because a referendum is likely to reject the deal. And then
leave it there.
Yeah.
Landon Thomas, Jr., financial correspondent for The New York Times, thank you so much for being with us on our underreported update on Iceland.